Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at some health concerns, not with humans, but with your pet. A lot of great information out there, but sometimes you'll read one thing and it'll be contradicted by something else you read elsewhere.
You got it. And, you know, every day I'm having to field questions from that owners found answers for from Dr. Google. And you really have to be careful with information that's online. And one of the thing that's, that kind of highlights this point that just came up is at the last American Veterinary Medical Association meeting, they passed a resolution to recommend that owners don't feed raw diets to their dogs and cats. This is not a law. It is a recommendation, and it's something that helps support what many veterinarians have been trying to make clear to owners that there are safety issues, and you can go about it safely, but you really have to be careful when you're using raw diets. And so it's just nice to have the AVMA kind of backing us up, and I just would recommend to anyone that wants to go down that path, they do talk to their veterinarian, and they'll be able to help you with making sure that you're dealing with a balanced diet. If they can't, then they can put you in touch with a nutritionist that may be able to help you with that.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest. You can join in with your questions or comments for her as we talk about your pet's health at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Well, I bet that announcement was met with
A lot of controversy because there's a lot of information out there online that says, you know, oh, raw diets are better, but none of it is backed up with any research. So it's all the Dr. Google stuff that people are looking at and trusting rather than their veterinarian.
We have Mary from Monroe on the phone, so let's talk to Mary. Hi, Mary.
Oh, good morning. Good morning. Thank you for the show.
Sure.
Got a question. I just, rather than let them be abandoned, I just took in a mama cat, mama farm cat, and two of her kittens. And as far as I know, mama cat has never had any shots, and as long as I've had the kittens, they haven't had any shots either. Mama cat is not happy being in the house all the time. She likes to roam, so she's going to continue being an outside cat. The kittens, I'm hoping, will get them to be indoor cats. My question is, this is going to be a strain on my budget with having triplets all at once.
Mm-hmm.
What shots do I need to get and think about for this newly found family of mine?
Yeah, well, how good of you to bring them in. And first of all, for the kittens, you know, to try to make sure that they do stay inside, make sure that you do provide them with a very enriched environment. Cat trees that they can climb up and down on, lots of toys. With having two cats in the household, then a minimum of three litter boxes in three different locations. You know, you're trying to make it the best home that you can so that the outside just doesn't look as inviting. And, you know, you can put bird feeders outside the window so they can see outside but just not be able to get out there. And it's not impossible to take an outdoor cat and make them an indoor cat, but, you know, they learn how to rip screens open and climb outdoors and so on. But so regarding your question, what do they need? I think it's very important that you get them in for veterinary checks. There's a good possibility, depending on when mom had these kittens, that she may be pregnant again. So to prevent more kittens from happening, make sure that the ones that you have adopted have been spayed or neutered. If cost is an issue, there are different ways that you can get this done. Many shelters will have discount spay-neuter programs, so check with your local Humane Society or shelter and see if they're able to help you with this, and often they can. And again, the Madison area, we have the Friends of Ferals, which is an organization where, you know, cats that are outdoors, they do provide assistance for people that have taken in some of these kitties. Regarding what they need for vaccines, I would make sure before they're vaccinated that they have a good physical exam. Because even though you can go to a pet store or just a drive-by vaccination clinic, probably the most important thing is to make sure that they're healthy and happy, that they don't have ear mites or fleas or intestinal parasites that could potentially be a risk for you. So that means taking them into a veterinary clinic for a physical exam, bring along a stool sample with you, and they should do a head-to-toe physical for you on your kitties to make sure that they are healthy and happy. At that time, they'll probably ask if they can can draw a little blood sample for a feline leukemia FIV, sort of like our HIV test. And this would be something that, because mom's an outside cat, and they're from her, she's potentially been exposed, just because obviously there's been stray cats to be able to get her pregnant in the area. And we know that, at least in the Madison area, we have about 3% of the strays that we see coming into the shelter situation test positive for one or the other of those diseases. So it's not super high, but I think when you're looking at it high enough, and because it's a fatal disease, you want to make sure that's done. After all of that, then you can start working on getting them vaccinated. Depending on your community, it is the law for rabies. You need to have that rabies certificate, even on indoor cats. And this is to protect your liability in case they were to bite somebody, and also to protect them, because we know that sometimes wildlife, especially bats, can get into the home and it can make for a big kerfuffle if we've got unvaccinated animals and rabies, a bat exposure. So getting them vaccinated for rabies is the law. And then rhinotracheitis, Khaleesi, and panleukopenia. That's a combination vaccine that all cats should get. And depending on the age of the kittens, at least 2 doses. And for mom, too, since this is the first time. So start saving your pennies. Get that vet visit in, and then, at that point, discussing, if money is an issue, is there a less expensive way that you can provide the appropriate care for them by going to perhaps a vaccination clinic that does not do physical exams?
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Mary. Arna in Viroqua. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. I'm so glad I finally get a chance to ask a question.
Oh, good.
It's about my kitty's feeding routine.
Uh-huh.
I want her to have a variety, so I give her dry food and canned food. But the only way I can get her to eat the canned food is if I give her small amounts 3 or 4 times a day,
mm-hmm.
which is fine when I'm home. But when someone else has to take care of her, nobody will do that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How can I change her routine so that it can be consistent when I'm gone?
Yeah, what you're finding is pretty normal cat behavior. If you polled a group of cats and asked them, how many meals would you like to eat a day? And this actually was a study that was done. They found that on average, cats like to eat about 13 little meals a day. And it's because they actually have a fairly small stomach. And cats being predators, where, eating mice and things, they're actually eating these small little packaged meals, throughout the day as they make catches. So, even domesticated cats that are indoors are going to prefer to maintain that type of eating behavior. Now, it's not impossible to change it, but it means that you may have to, wear headphones or something to just kind of say, I'm not going to feed you, and try to cut out a meal and have her eat other ones. Alternatively, there are automatic feeders that you can use that work very well even for canned food. They have a spot for an ice pack to be inserted, little chambers that rotating door will open up and reveal a little bit of food. So if you do have to have a pet sitter that just comes in once a day, they can still dole out the food and just set it on a timer for the cat to be able to go over and eat her food. Obviously, this would be something you would want to work on while you're at home, because you're introducing something brand new to her. But that may be something that you could look into, and they're not that expensive.
No,
really, they're pretty
really
inexpensive.
Not. Good luck. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. An email from Steve in Madison. Could you talk about how to evaluate the degree of visual impairment in an aging dog? What are the considerations for cataract surgery for dogs? Things like price, outcomes. I just had cataract surgery myself.
You did.
So,
and they do exactly the same surgery in dogs. Yeah,
they
really do. And cost, I'm not going to be able to provide that. Unfortunately, I work right around the corner from our ophthalmologist, but it's not, I can tell you it's not an inexpensive surgery, but if you have pet insurance, it's often covered. So that would be something to be looking into. But, checking visual impairment, it's so subjective. It's watching the animal walk around a novel room, putting up little cones and barriers and just seeing, you know, are they visual? You know, sometimes we'll do things while the pet's sitting there, throw cotton balls, you know, towards the pet so they're not hitting the pet, but we'll catch them in their field of view and see if the dog pays attention to it. It's not like us where we can put up a visual chart and say, hey, you know, read these letters. And they can't tell us for sure. But many dogs that are visually impaired, it happens so gradually that they learn coping mechanisms. And as long as you don't rearrange the furniture, you provide them with safety outside with the fenced backyard and make sure there's no swimming pools or anything like that for them to fall into, they get along amazingly well. And they really pick up that sense of smell. And you just see them walking along and maybe lightly bumping into something. But, you know, they just continue to, you know, on they go. And I'm always amazed when I get a dog in that is blind in our exam room and the owners didn't even know it, because it happened slowly and they're like, we didn't even know they were blind, because they just get along so well in the house. So, you know, not all dogs with cataracts need to have them removed if they're coping well, but some of them, they do much better emotionally by having their cataracts removed.
Well, I know I'm doing better emotionally myself.
Good.
Having mine removed. Oh, Larry and Madison, hi.
Yes, thank you. A question about our female kitty, about 11 years old. Lately, she has been taking to pulling out just real clumps of hair, kind of alarming array of hair around her when she's when we see her sometimes, and then also profusely shedding. We have brushed her. My wife has brushed her a couple of times rather vigorously, but just wonder if that's something to be concerned about or not.
Is she actually having areas of hair loss now where she's pulling out these clumps of hair?
We haven't noticed it. Her coat looks a little different, a little bit, a little bit more matted, I guess I would say.
Okay.
But haven't noticed any actual bald spots.
An 11-year-old cat is not that old. I mean, they are classified as a senior citizen, but if you have a hair coat change, that's one of the things that we kind of look at as a, something to determine whether they're healthy or not. Mm-hmm. And so this would be a good indication to say, we better get her in to have her looked at. I'm not sure whether it's just, you know, she's not hasn't been grooming herself, maybe because she hasn't been feeling well, or she's arthritic, or there's something going on, and so she does have these hair mats that are bothering her, and so she's grabbing those and pulling on them, or whether she has a reason for being itchy. You know, when we have cats that are over grooming, that's why I was asking if she's actually pulling hair out, because we'll see cats that just groom to the point where they have bald spots on their body, and sometimes their skin is normal underneath, sometimes it's abnormal. But you know, when we see that, we know that there's a, you know, a whole host of things that could cause it. But about 30% of those cats actually respond to flea control. So I don't know if your cat's an indoor-outdoor cat and whether this is truly a cat that's itchy, but the easiest thing you could do would be institute flea control using one of the monthly products that your veterinarian would recommend. You know, and this would be, you know, it's just one of those little spot-on things that would be safe for a cat. You'd want to make sure that it is a cat-approved product. But I think it's time to get her in and have that looked at, because something's going on.
Yeah, excuse me. We just have gone through that. She has a sister, a litter mate. We just went through this over-grooming with her sister, and that seems to be cleared up. They're both strictly indoor cats.
Okay, okay.
We'll take advice and get her in.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Lots of callers online. I think we'll just go right back to the phones and to Janine in Toma, Wisconsin. Hi, Janine.
Hi, I have a Bichon Poodle mix. It's dealing with bladder stones. She's about 2 years old and had a surgery last week on them. We're still waiting to find out what kind they are, but just recommendations on diet and possible prognosis.
Yeah, well, that's going to depend on what these stones are, and I'm glad that your veterinarian has sent them in. Most of the stones for stone analysis, you know, go to an outside lab, and it can take a week or two or even longer to get the results back. But depending on what type of stone it is and whether this has been associated with a urinary tract infection, I assume they probably have cultured the urine as well to see if there was any signs of infection there, because sometimes stones form when there is an infection present. Other times they can be kind of a genetic type problem where certain breeds of dogs are more prone to developing certain types of stones than others. So once you get that analysis back, then that will tell you whether your dog needs to be on a specific diet, like an acidifying diet, or a diet that is going to be, you know, looking at it, keeping it more, the urine more alkaline, or there's all kinds of things that we have to look at. And, so I really can't answer your question regarding prognosis until you get that stone result back. And, you know, I'll be back next month, I think the 14th or something. Yep. I can't remember.
September 11th.
September 11th. Okay. So today's the 14th. But so get that stone result and either, you know, email me or, you know, call in at the next show and then I can talk to you about it at that point. But it sounds like she's in good hands with the veterinary care that she's getting.
Yep. Good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Janine. Dawn in Wausau. Hi to you.
Hi. I have actually two questions, and I might as well talk about the stone question first. It involves cats. And my senior cat, he actually had stones when he was younger. He actually had both struvite and oxalate, which the vet said was very odd.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess he follows after his mother's odd medical history. So
okay.
So I've been able to keep him... he hasn't had any episodes since I changed him to wet food.
Okay.
And grain-free, so it was increased protein. And then I make kind of a kitty soup.
Okay.
By adding water to it.
All right.
However, he has, started to throw up the food. And I've been kind of concerned because my mother's cats are also throwing up the food. And now with all the recalls, I'm a bit paranoid. So... I was wondering if there are any other foods. I'm doing wellness, which has been working for the longest time. I'm afraid to change because it has been working.
Yeah, yeah. But if
any new recommendations?
Yeah, you know, most cats that have bladder stones, typically we would put them on a prescription diet, a therapeutic diet that's going to meet their needs and limit the intake. And in the case of calcium oxalate stones, they like to grow in an acid environment, and struvite stones like to grow in a alkaline environment. And so most of the diets that we use for kitties are going to meet both those needs, and they're called, like, there's like Hills has one called SO diet, I think that's Hills makes that, or CV Multi is their food. SO diet is a different company, but so they've got newer diets out there that work very well. So I just put that out there that you've been lucky with just using a commercial diet that you've been able to keep them from coming back. Increasing water intake definitely keeps the cat hydrated and, you know, keeps them urinating more, so there's less chance of sludge and stuff forming in their bladder. So I'm glad things have worked out that way. But the change, just like the one of the last callers that said their cat's hair coat has changed and it looks rougher, vomiting is one of those things that it is an alarm that goes off that, you know, why is this cat suddenly had a change and it's vomiting? Is it the diet? Is it something else because your kitty is now a little bit older? Is there a medical reason for it? And so rather than just turning to diet, I think it's, you know, warrants that your cat be checked by your veterinarian, perhaps get a senior chem panel done. I would definitely recommend getting a urine sample checked. And remember, for cat urine, it's so concentrated in most cases that if you take a urine sample and want to evaluate it for the presence of crystals or anything like that, it needs to be run hot off the press. You can't let it sit on the counter for more than 30 minutes, or minerals are going to start to come out of solution and it's going to skew your results. So it's got to be, you know, right from the cat and into the centrifuge and under the microscope to have a look at it. But I think it's important to get your kitty in. You know, again, I doubt that it's the diet. I mean, there are the AVMA does have, on their website, pet food recall, kind of updates on there. And I think the reason why we're seeing so many is not that pet food's getting worse. I think that we're just getting more involved with following and checking. And because pets have become, so much a part of our lives, as I said, they've gone from the bedroom or from the barnyard to the bedroom, that, the fact that they're spending so much time with us, we are, as a profession, wanting to keep them as healthy as we can. And so we watch these, commercial diets like hawks, and things are found out, and things get reported, in sometimes even before there's even been any reported illnesses from it. So I would still think that your best bet is staying with a brand name commercial diet, but your vet's going to have to tell you which is going to be the appropriate one according to your cat's health.
Okay. All right. And real quick, if we have time for a behavioral question.
Sure.
I and this didn't correlate with the start of the vomiting of the food, but I introduced a new senior cat. He was a 14-year-old Himalayan that nobody wanted because he was too old, everyone said, but I thought that's just silly. So he's been a wonderful cat, and he got an excellent checkup. The only thing with introducing him that has maintained is when they surprise each other around a corner.
Okay.
So, he very much has always been a very gentleman and doesn't engage, but the one thing he started doing is when they kind of, when the resident cats kind of run off, like, boy, that wasn't fun getting surprised with him around the corner, he's now been triggered to run after them and jump on their back.
Yeah, he's got that predatory response. What I would be recommending is putting a bell on your new cat, on the Himalayan, something that's going to be kind of that early warning signal to your other cats. So if they're walking around the corner and they hear a little jingle or something going on, then they know, hey, don't round the corner because you're going to get startled. And I think that makes life a little bit easier. I don't know how you introduce these kitties, but it's real important when you're bringing a new cat in that you do it gradually and slowly. I call it a dating process, letting them get used to each other's odors at first without seeing each other, then letting them see each other with not being able to have contact either through a glass or a screen door until you can see that they're calm and inquisitive. And then gradually let them come together under supervision. But I would be, trying to make sure that you're giving that. It sounds like the Himalayan has lots of energy for a 14-year-old cat. So, again, making sure that you, play, give him a real enriched environment and spend 30 minutes a couple times a day with cat toys on strings and wands so he gets his predatory chase and attack response out on a toy rather than your other kitties.
And good luck. And thanks a lot for calling, Dawn. Appreciate it. And Beverly in Rushford. Hi.
Hi. Dr. Sawchuk, I had my 5-year-old German Shepherd tested for heartworm this spring, and they found in the one blood draw that she had no signs of heartworm, but she was off the charts with anaplasmosis with Lyme.
Okay. Well, anaplasma and Lyme disease are both transmitted by the same tick, the deer tick, or also known as Ixodes. And so we in Wisconsin are seeing a lot of co-infections, meaning that they've been bit by a tick and picked up both of those diseases simultaneously. And although they're passed by the same tick, the disease presentation can be very different. Most pets that get exposed to these diseases never become symptomatic. And so that's just a kind of an important thing to put in the back of your mind that they may never, ever show any symptoms. But things that I would be recommending, if we get an anaplasma positive case back on the little SNAP test, we can follow up with a couple of things. One would be to do a blood cell count. Probably the worst thing that can happen in a pet that has anaplasma is their blood cell counts drop. In particular, a type of cell called a platelet, which is involved with the clotting of blood. So having a CBC or a blood cell count done by your veterinarian would help to let us know whether we're having any trouble with the bone marrow with that particular organism. There is another test that you can do to confirm whether that positive test was really truly positive, and it's called a PCR test and has to be sent to an outside lab. Regarding the Lyme positive, this gets a little controversial. There's a new test that Cornell University has just come out with called the multiplex test, which is, it looks at antibody levels to the Lyme organism and is supposedly able to differentiate the difference between acute infection and chronic infection. If it shows the fact that it's a chronic infection, then treatment probably would not be indicated. But if it's acute, you know, there may be a response to some therapy with a drug called doxycycline, which is an antibiotic. So that might be a test that your veterinarian may run. They may
We did that.
And what did you get back on that?
Nothing. That's why I was going to ask you, now that that antibiotic procedure has all been done, she still does not show any symptoms, but should I have a blood test done again for her to find out if she is free of anything and how reliable are the diagnoses of Lyme?
That's that is a very controversial topic, and it's because so many pets test positive. And we know that, you know, exposure, it's out there. I mean, we see this, we live in Tick Central. In fact, we've got the Lone Star tick knocking on our door down in the southern part of the state as well. And so we're going to be having even new tick-borne diseases being transmitted up here. I think your big thing, now that your dog is test positive, they will always test positive, most likely. You can, there is a test, and again, internal medicine folks think it's not very reliable, but it can be run, that's called C6 quantitative antibody level. It's run by the same company that makes the little snap test that was run to initially diagnose your dog. And that actually gives you a number that's supposed to correlate with the possibility of infection happening. And again, this is controversial. And I know our internal medicine folks at the vet school are kind of going, you know, we probably shouldn't be, you know, relying on this. But sometimes that's the only thing that we can help an owner realize, that, you know, if it comes back as a very, very low number, it's probably nothing to worry about, that your dog was exposed, but at low levels, and, you know, the chance of them becoming clinically infected is probably pretty slim. So that might be another test that could be run by your veterinarian. But anaplasma positive dogs, the current recommendations are to check a blood cell count right at diagnosis, and again 6 months later, and perhaps annually after that if they're remaining positive. So that would be the only blood work I'd be recommending right now.
Thanks, Beverly. We have an email from Dawn in Madison who says, I have a female cat about four, small, around 4 or 5 pounds. She vomits often at least 4 to 5 times a week. The contents look like it's just hair with a little yellow bile. Is this something I should be worried about, or is it something I can do to prevent it?
That's a tiny cat, and that's a lot of vomiting. And I think the problem that, as a veterinarian, I see is people overinterpreting the presence of hair in vomitus. Not all hair, you know, hair in vomit means that the cat has a hairball problem. The hair may just be going along for the ride because your cat's grooming itself every day and it's vomiting for another reason. And there's a list as long as my arm as things that can cause a cat to vomit, from parasites, even things that live in the stomach, to intestinal tract. There are even things like heartworm can cause chronic vomiting in cats, and that may be the only symptom that you see is chronic vomiting. Your cat may have, with the fact that you are seeing this bile problem, some type of motility disorder where bile's getting into the stomach and causing irritation. Your kitty may have primary liver disease with the fact that it's vomiting up bile, may have an inflammatory bowel or gastric disease too. So, I sound like a broken record on today's show, but take your cat in and get started. And the first thing would be probably getting some lab work done, having a stool sample checked. Get those easy things out of the way before you start on the gastrointestinal extravaganza workup, which can involve everything from x-rays and barium swallows to scoping and special blood work for, you know, GI studies and so on. So there's a lot of things that can be done. But first step is get your cat in for a good physical.
Facebook question from Mara. We have just adopted a four-month-old kitty who was raised on milk, fish, and raw eggs. How do we transition her to dry food? And should we give her a mix of canned and dry, or is dry food adequate?
I like cats to have a little bit of both. I know that dry food's very convenient because you can leave it out and they can eat it and it's not going to go bad. But the wet food tends to be a little bit lower in carbohydrates. It's, there's less processing involved. And it is smelly and you can't keep it out very long because it's going to go bad fast. But I like to see cats get a combination of them if we can. And, you know, 4 months of age, cats learn food preference very, very early in life. And this may be a tough thing to break, but I think that if you started out with maybe taking the diet that it's currently on and maybe adding in some canned food or some canned food to it and gradually segueing over to, you know, just canned, adding, you know, leaving some dry out for the cat to be able to eat, as well, that will hopefully work for your kitty. But it may be tough to, because it's been on this diet and it may have developed dietary preferences.
Jean in Columbus. Hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm not sure what I'm really picking on. I guess I'm trying to decide where this problem is coming from. I have a wonderful 11-year-old blind pug. He's been blind since he was 8. We also have a wonderful veterinarian. We've been treating our dog over the last year, though, for some liver function problems and also for parasites that came from eating rabbit poop. Dog can't see anywhere except it can certainly find the rabbit poop.
Yeah.
But the problem is that the dog walks in circles all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, it's only started in the last few months, and I'm trying to figure out what it's related to.
Well, you know, first of all, I'm going to go back to your rabbit dropping issue. There are really no parasites in rabbit stool that are pathogenic for dogs. There is one that we see commonly when we do a stool check that is a coccidia organism that goes by the name of Imeria. And I don't know if that's the one that your veterinarian's been diagnosing, but that is, the dog is basically just acting like a big tube. It's going in one end and out the other, and they're seeing it under the microscope and saying, yep, there's these parasite eggs here. That means your dog ate rabbit poop in the last day or two. So we see that all the time, and that does not need to be treated. And so if that is the parasite, don't worry about treating, because the treatment for coccidia can be quite problematic. Typically, we use one of two drugs. One is a sulfadimethoxine, which is a sulfa drug that can affect the eyes and the kidneys and so on. So you have to be pretty, you know, careful with using it. And then the other is an off-label use of a horse product that is called Panaziril, which we are starting to use a little bit more now. So that doesn't sound like that would be an issue. I'd go back to your veterinarian and say, just what are you seeing? If this is Imeria, you may, you know, want to go back and review your parasitology notes. There is a great website for you to go to that even though it's made for veterinarians, it's you know, pretty easy to follow. It's called the Companion Animal Parasite Council is the group, and it's CAPC vet.org. And when you get to the main, you know, startup page, there's the alphabet across the top. Click on the C, that'll bring up coccidia, and you can go down and you'll see there's a little write-up there about the fact that we periodically will see Imerian dogs poop from eating bunny or, you know, bunny droppings, and it doesn't have to be, you know, doesn't have to be treated. So that's the easy thing. The walking in circles. Good question. Your dog's been blind for a long time. Sometimes dogs that have acutely lost their senses may develop some compulsive disorders because they're anxious, and this is some kind of a way of relieving anxiety, doing kind of a repetitive motion. But being an 11-year-old pug now that's been blind for 3 years to suddenly start doing this in the last few weeks, I start worrying about things like, does he have a middle ear infection? Does he have a brain tumor? Is there, you know, something like that going on that's just kind of slowly causing your dog to do these big circles? And having a thorough neurologic exam done, I think, would be in your dog's best interest to rule out, is there something like that going on? So, and if your veterinarian has concerns or questions, we do have a full neurology staff at the veterinary school. And if they are thinking that it may be something like this, getting, you know, a workup done, including an MRI of your dog's brain, may be indicated.
Mm-hmm.
There okay, you well, go. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Jeanette in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi. Hi. You two are both so wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy you so much. I'm kind of, my husband and I are grandma and grandpa to a little Chihuahua Rat Terrier cross. So we're watching while this young couple is moving to a new home. And we're hoping we can be more than grandma and grandpa, but we're taking it slow. And the dog is spending most of its time with us. And every once in a while, it'll stay overnight with the other family.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm calling about is she's kind of a nervous little dog, and she's always kind of licking. Well, they're in the process of clearing out some mold out of this place that they're moving into, and all of a sudden she's developed two little red bumps on one of her feet. And I don't know, could it be from mold or from licking? Is it a hot spot?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we will see dogs right between their toes, kind of right where the skin meets. They'll get what's called interdigital cysts, and sometimes you'll see ingrown hairs in there. You'll get bacterial infections. So it's possible that that may be what's going on. But if the dog has been licking at its feet, then it may be a self-induced skin irritation. There may be a bacterial infection or a yeast infection. But typically molds in the environment are not going to cause localized sores like that. It may trigger an allergic response. It may cause some respiratory signs, but I wouldn't expect it to cause just a couple of focal areas on the feet. But because this is a possibility that this is an infection, even though you're maybe just the grandpa and grandma, you may want to consider getting this dog in so that cytology can be done on these. We do this all the time. In fact, my dog, I just had him in last week, has an interdigital cyst between a couple of his front toes, and we had to, you know, clean it all up, and he's on antibiotics, and we're trying to, you know, get it better, and that may be what's going to happen to this little one too. So maybe, you know, that what you can do is take the little puppy into a vet clinic to have that looked at.
Yep,
we sure will. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Jeanette, for calling. Appreciate it. And Mike in Fifield, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Good. I've got a quick question. It's about a Bernese Mountain Dog.
Mm-hmm.
And he's about a year and a half old and in perfect health, but I have recently heard rumors or whatever about that they are susceptible to a lot of health problems.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard that?
Well, it is one of the dogs that is definitely overrepresented in our oncology unit, our cancer unit, and they are a breed that we do see a lot of cancer in. So that's probably our big thing. I always recommend when someone is going to be adopting another dog or adopting the first time dog or whatever, that they do their homework. And this is one of these things that, you know, going in with your eyes wide open so that you can say, you know, okay, I'm going to try to work with the burner breeder. I want to see what was the cause of death for over the last several generations of dogs. And a good breeder should keep those kind of records so that you have some idea of what you're getting into genetically. But that's probably the big thing. But because they are a large breed dog, they're also prone to a lot of orthopedic issues. We'll see hip dysplasia and knee problems. And so keeping your dog lean so that there's less stress on those joints is very, very important just because of their size.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so is there anything I can do to prevent any of that?
Well, you know, so much of it is going to be genetic. You know, when it comes to orthopedic disease, keeping them thin, okay, you have to have good genes. And so making sure that the breeder has been checking her breeding, so his or her breeding stock for, you know, hip issues and so on, and that should be something that you got with paperwork on purchasing this little dog, or big dog, I should say. You know, when it comes to the cancer issue, you know, again, keeping your dog lean, we know that obesity is one of the causes of increased risk of cancer in dogs, but it basically comes down to good genes. And so, you know, good nutrition, you know, keeping your dog fit, is going to be your best medicine. And then, you know, going in for annual to semi-annual, physical exams to catch things early so that, you know, treatment's going to be more successful.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Mike. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for listening. And you can join in. Actually, send us a photo of your pet. We'd love to see that. Go to the Larry Mueller Show, our Facebook page, and you can post a picture there and also ask a question there. Or you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Shoot us an email at talk@wpr.org. And a Facebook question from Mary. Our golden retriever always starts itching and getting hot spots this time of year. We bathe her with a dermatological pet shampoo, give her fish oil capsules year-round, feed her food that's supposed to be good for allergies. This happens every year and lasts until the first frost. We give her Benadryl and treat the hot spots as they come. Not ideal, though. She still itches, though it's lessened, and the medicine makes her droopy. Any ideas?
Well, yes. Okay. So number one, I mean, we're talking about genetics in dogs, and that's selective breeding is probably your best thing. Golden retrievers are the poster child for allergies. And the fact that this is seasonal really makes me think that your dog has allergies. You know, starting treatment early is probably your best bet. And so working with your veterinarian, as soon as you start, you know, being suspicious that your pet has allergies, making sure that your pet doesn't have any secondary infections. It's amazing how many pets that have allergies have traumatized their skin enough that they have yeast infections and bacterial infections that just add to the itch. And so they just keep on that itch scratch cycle just keeps on going. You can try to avoid common allergens if you can. Now, the fact that your dog's allergic this time of the year makes me think that it's probably stuff that's outside. So, you know, avoiding, you know, house dust mites and so on and going through all of that is probably not going to be helpful. But just kind of standard suggestions would be to, you know, wash your pet's bedding daily, using a HEPA air filter to keep the air clean and, you know, running your central air to keep the particulate matter from outside from getting into the house. I don't know how often you're bathing your dog, but dogs with allergies really benefit from being bathed every 3 to 7 days. And you'd want to use like a real mild antimicrobial shampoo, usually something with chlorhexidine. So I don't know what that dermatologic shampoo is, but I hope one of the active ingredients is chlorhexidine. Make sure you're using flea control. You'd be surprised how many people say, oh, my pet has never had fleas. And flea allergy dermatitis is so common, and all it takes is one flea bite. So this is the time of the year when fleas start coming out. We start seeing them increasing in numbers, usually in August and September, at least in this part of Wisconsin. You can try using a skin-friendly diet. It sounds like you've got her on fish oils and so on, but there are some diets that are a little bit better for dogs, and your vet can help decide whether the diet with the combination of fish oils that you're using is appropriate or whether a therapeutic diet would be helpful. And then when it comes to how do you stop the itch, you've got your dog on Benadryl. Most dogs continue to itch through that, but you may want to try a topical steroid spray on some of the spots that are itchy, like the feet and so on. That may make the dog feel a little bit more comfortable. I don't like using steroids. I find that, you know, avoiding Pred is probably in your dog's best interest. But there is a drug called cyclosporine that we can use that's very safe. It's a little pricey, especially for big dogs, but that's a great substitute instead of using steroids. And strongly consider getting your dog allergy testing. Now that we have a new method of controlling allergies, we don't have to use allergy shots to control your dog's allergies. There is a sublingual drop that was just released by the UW, by one of our prominent dermatologists, Dr. DeBoer. He just presented all his data, and it's now commercially available not through regular veterinarians, but through veterinary dermatologists. It will be out to regular veterinarians in private practice very soon. But the Heska company is now taking over the production of these, and it's so easy. It's just a little squirt in their mouth, under their tongue, to treat them. And I think it's going to make a big difference in the way we manage our dogs. So that's a lot of information for just an email question, but hopefully they were listening. Yeah.
All right. We have Kent in Milwaukee next. Hi, Kent. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Good morning. We have a 19-year-old cat that's mostly Maine Coon, And he's been a fairly large cat all of his life, but recently he's been losing quite a bit of weight. And his appetite seems to be the same. So I'm just curious whether it's normal to lose weight as he gets as they age, or if there's something we should worry about.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I harp on the students is anytime we get a pet in, I always like to look at what did they weigh on the last visit, what do they weigh now. And when we see, if it's like a teeny tiny amount, like a quarter of a pound or something on a fairly large cat, I don't get too worried about it. But if it's, you know, significant, then I start thinking that there's probably a medical basis for it. Yes, because they're a little lazier, they're going to have some muscle atrophy. They may be arthritic and not using their muscles as much. But if you are noticing weight loss in your cat, the big things that we want to rule out are, does your cat have a condition called hyperthyroidism, an overactive thyroid gland? Can be diagnosed sometimes on physical exam. Your veterinarian may feel a small nodule in your cat's neck if your cat cooperates and sits still. Sometimes they have a rapid heart rate and a heart murmur associated with it. But it really comes down to getting a blood sample sent to a lab that can measure a T4 level. Then the other condition that we see commonly in aged cats, and it often goes hand in hand with cats that are hyperthyroid, is kidney disease. And cats that have kidney disease will sometimes start wasting as well. So getting a full chemistry as well as a urine sample check to see if there's something like that going on. If your cat is hypothyroid or hyperthyroid, it is a disease that can be treated medically, and there's a couple of different ways of medicating them. One is with a tablet given orally, and then the other is a gel that gets put on the inside of their ear. I know it sounds a little weird, but it's absorbed through the skin. It's a transdermal gel. So for cats that hate being pilled, it's an easy way of getting them medicated. So another one that needs to go back to the veterinarian.
There you go, Kent. And Julia in Mondovi. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a 2.5-year-old Yorkie, neutered. He's 5 pounds average. And we were going away for a Boy Scout camp. So we took him to a kennel. This was a different kennel than we had normally used. He has been at kennels before and never had any problems. We took him to the kennel a day early because of their check-in times in our leave time. And apparently when I went through all the instructions, everything about feeding, everything to do with him, he apparently had a fall. The owner of the kennel said that he dropped him. He didn't call me. He called our vet, and that was like 24 hours later. But he said he had dropped him from about 5 feet. He said he landed on his head.
Oh.
Ouch.
And I'm just having a hard time. He said when he went to get him out of the kennel, he was cowering in the back, and that's really unlike our dog because he's kind of bubbly. And you open the kennel, he's like coming right out, you know, come on, take me out, let me lick you all over kind of thing. And so I'm just wondering, you know, what the chances are of a dog falling on their head.
Well, I mean, it's possible. I mean, it's something that you would never want to have happen. That's why, you know, boarding kennels should be insured. You know, when it's an injury like that that happens, that, you know, they should be able to at least, you know, pay any medical expenses. Did you tour the kennel to see where your pet was staying?
Yes. I actually went back there with and put him in to the kennel myself.
Okay. And it was elevated off the ground?
Yes.
Okay.
Just about my waist high, and the gentleman himself is about the same height as me. He's probably about 5'7".
Okay.
But it's about maybe about 3 feet.
Okay.
Okay.
Ground. Yeah, I mean, if he, you know, jumped out of the cage, I wouldn't expect him to land on his head. And dogs at home can be very different in their kennels compared to when they're hospitalized or in a boarding kennel. If there was another dog barking, he may have been very frightened. But, you know, anyone that is well versed in handling animals would have probably, you know, used a blanket or something, or sat and talked to the dog and offered treats and tried to coax the dog forward and, you know, scoop the dog up and bring them up into their arms. You know, I, again, it's one of those things where I think that, talking to the kennel and just see if you can get, the straight story as to what happened, especially if there's any aftermath with your dog having any head injury signs or, seizures or anything like that. Make sure everything is documented as to what happened.
Right, yeah. And there is. We actually, the vet had to keep him. The kennel assistant the next day said that he was staggering, and so then they still waited out because I had him being fed three times a day, and they said they walked him four times a day.
Yeah,
and he had only been there just for that day. We took him Saturday morning, and this apparently happened Saturday evening, and then they brought him to our vet Saturday or Sunday night.
Mm-hmm.
But he has nerve damage. She did an X-ray, and she gave him some morphine and anti-swelling. Because his tongue was hanging out.
Oh, my goodness.
He's not able to use his tongue. Going for the 10th day.
Well,
so
it sounds,
have an MRI and maybe go. She said he had a fracture at number 3, what they could see on the X-ray.
Wow, before. So he's got a cervical fracture.
Yeah.
And, he needs specialized care. And I would make sure that, boy, you either work with an attorney and, get, because this is going to be a long ordeal for your dog. Good luck.
Yeah, it's going to be a very expensive.
Yeah, but, again, an insured kennel is going to be able to, they're going to be, able to perhaps cover all those medical expenses for you. So I hope your little dog does well.
Yeah, me too. Julia, thank you. I appreciate your call very much. Well, we have, that was kind of a sad, happen very often.
No, and I think that there are good kennels and there are bad kennels. And the best advice I can give people is before you leave your pet in the care of somebody else, make sure you are going back and seeing where they're staying, maybe even having a day dry run to see how does the dog do in the kennel before you do that.
Mm-hmm. And even sometimes the good kennels, there can be problems.
There can be problems, yep.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest, till 12:30 here on the Ideas Network. Well, if you're like me, the animals that are part of your family are very important to you, and you want to keep them healthy and happy. And new information comes along sometimes, different opinions on that new information. We wonder where to turn. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. We're glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk with us from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She's with us until 12:30 to share information and some great advice, as she always does. I hope you'll join in. Cat owners, dog owners, can't imagine life without a cat or two around. This is the program for you. And Dr. Sandy's ready to answer your questions when you call us at 1-800-642-1234. Hey, post a photo of your pet on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. You can also post a question there or email us at talk@wpr.org. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network as we visit about your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Glad to have her come by. She comes by once a month to talk with us. She'll be back September 11th, but for now, she's with us till 12:30, so let's take advantage of her.
All right.
Let's do that. Don, and you had a comment you wanted to make.
Yeah, I think this whole raw food diet thing has been, it's so controversial. I started out, talking about the fact that the AVMA came up with this resolution to say, discourage pet owners from feeding raw diets. And the reason why they're doing it is not for the health of the pet, but for the health of the people. Because, even though you may wash their dishes and, clean up, you're still dealing with stool and stool residue and all those things that you are, and there's saliva and, you name it. So you got to go about it very carefully. And I know there was an email from somebody that had said that veterinarians are, losing lots of money because of the raw food push. And, therapeutic diets are not a money maker for us at all. And in fact, you can order them online now, and there's lots of places you can get them. And I think that it's that risk. If you've got a pet with a diagnosed health problem, why add to it by maybe feeding a diet that may be deficient or contaminated with material? And there was an article published recently looking at pet treats, and in particular one called the Bully Stick. And when they interviewed people, they, you know, I thought it was kind of interesting. 45% of people that use this, 600 people that got interviewed, didn't even know what body part it came from. And you can guess it's the male member of a bull, okay, that has been dried. And when they cultured these things, and people buy them and are handling them with their bare hands, they found that they found methicillin-resistant staph, they found clostridium, they found salmonella, they found E. coli. I mean, it was amazing. Everything, you know, all these things that are putting us at risk, and we're bringing these into our home and laying them on our carpet and having our infant crawl around and so on. So you just got to be careful when you're having a pet in the house and feeding them either a raw diet or kind of body part treats.
All right. Don and Dousman, thanks for calling. Hi.
Thank you for letting me on. Yeah, I have a comment. I've called in before, but not to this particular doctor, about cat owners that let their cats out and how many birds and other little creatures that they kill. And I really think that people are under the influence that, you know, cats are natural-born hunters, and I guess they are, but when you have the pet, to me it's a pet. You keep it in the house, or you put it on a leash, or in a, then outside you don't let it run loose like that. And it's not only good for the birds and other nature, but it's good for the cat. There's a lot of diseases that they can get. There's a lot of other feral cats that could harm them or kill them.
Oh, I agree totally. I agree totally. When you look at life expectancy, you know, indoor-outdoor cats have a much lower life expectancy than strictly indoor cats, and it's because, you know, they're just not picking up the diseases and the traumas and everything else that can happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think, you know, you gave a little talk earlier in the program kind of saying about letting those cats that were outside cats, to, you know, trying to bring them in. But I think, you know, if we could educate people more on what they're doing to other creatures out there. I've lost so many of my songbirds because of cats around here, and I've caught three so far. I bring them to Waukesha at the Humane Society, and now I'm starting to think by catching them, well, another cat moves into the territory.
Yeah, and that gets into the whole like cat colonies, the feral cat colonies. It's, you know, are we actually doing a service having these cats, you know, staying out there in the environment, passing on fleas and toxoplasmosis and, you know, and so on. So there's lots of concerns about this, and it's an extremely controversial area, you know, especially for people that are, you know, wanting to support these outdoor cat colonies. So thank you very much for your opinion.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much. We have Carl in River Falls with a question for you, Sandy. Hi, Carl.
We have a golden retriever with ear infections, usually one every 3 months. And I was wondering, is there any home remedies that we could be using? Vet bills become quite expensive, and the cream that they give us is usually about $20.
Well, I think the big thing that I would be recommending is that you get to the bottom of why your dog is getting these recurrent ear infections. There's probably a couple of reasons. You know, the ear is a wonderful barrier, and there was a study done where they actually took Q-tips that were covered with yeast and bacteria and inserted it in a healthy, normal dog's ear, and nothing grew. I mean, they didn't develop an infection. So when we see dogs with recurrent ear infections, it's usually because we've got some underlying reason, either the microenvironment, such as, you know, you take a Shar Pei that has the little narrow, tiny ear canals where they don't get a lot of good air circulation, or the Cocker Spaniel that has really greasy ears and more sebum production, or the Golden Retriever that's prone to having allergic dermatitis. And the big allergy organs for dogs are ears and feet, and sometimes it's just the ears that are involved as well. So getting to the bottom of this, seeing, you know, if your dog's swimming a lot, do you have, you know, a lot of water, and are they macerating and then allowing the normal flora that are there to take over? So, you know, when I get a dog in, especially a Golden Retriever that has an ear infection, I'll tell people this is going to be a lifetime problem unless you stay on top of it. And it's not something that you just treat for 10 days and then forget about it. It's routine keeping the hair trimmed away from the ear canal. It's using routine cleaners appropriately and making sure that your veterinarian or the vet tech at your vet clinic shows you how to clean the ears appropriately. And, you know, not all your cleaners are created equally. And I've had people say, oh, I'm using vinegar and water. That does not work. So you really need to use something that's acidifying, that has a surfactant, maybe it will leave a protective barrier down. And so, you know, using an ear cleaner appropriately on a regular basis, whether you think your dog needs it or not. So get into the habit of every Sunday you clean your dog's ears. And then also paying attention, daily looking at the ears. So many of these dogs, it starts out with the ears becoming inflamed. They just look a little pink. They're a little red. They haven't started to develop an infection. They're just inflamed. I will send home for these dogs a bottle of just steroid ear drops. Our pharmacy makes them up, a dexamethasone ear drop that doesn't have any antibacterial or antifungal properties, and that will help get that inflammation under control, which is usually the cause of them then developing an infection. So you see what I'm getting at, working on keeping things at bay, not just putting the fires out when they happen. So it comes down to a lot of home care on your part. So, I'm sorry you bought a dog that has expensive medical bills. That's golden. I mean, you get them, you're going to expect that you're going to have orthopedic problems, cancer problems, and skin problems. It's just part and parcel with the breed. Yeah.
There you go, Carol. Thank you for calling. And we had an email from Julie who has a cat. Looks like it has a canker sore on the inside of its lip or mouth. What could that be?
My guess is it's something that's called, the nickname is called a rodent ulcer, and it has nothing to do with rodents. It's one of the ways that this syndrome in cats, it's called an eosinophilic granuloma syndrome. The eosinophils are a type of white blood cell that we see produced in response to allergic diseases. And for some reasons, cats get these things, these little ulcerated areas on their lip. They may get them sometimes down the back of their thigh or in other places of their body, but the one on their lip is definitely one of the most common. The way we treat these is with steroids, and I've mentioned in the past that I don't like using steroids, but this is one of these skin conditions that steroid treatment works very well to get this under control. So usually we'll use an injectable steroid that lasts for a couple of weeks, get them back in again. They will usually need two or three injections to try to get this under control.
Beth in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a 14-year-old French bulldog. Her name is Rumor. And the last couple of years, she has been increasingly urinating in the house. We have wood floors with, rugs that we can wash. And lately I've noticed that she is drinking what I feel is an excessive amount of water for what I've, paid attention to her drinking in the past.
Okay.
Do you think we got something going on with her?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
I thought so.
Yeah. Sometimes older dogs, there's a couple of things when they're having accidents in the house. If it's just urine, then, ruling out things like urinary tract infections, are they incontinent? So are they laying down and just dribbling urine out, or are they actively just squatting and voiding? Do they have some underlying medical problems such as kidney disease where their kidneys are lacking the ability to concentrate their urine, so they produce more dilute urine, lots of it, and have to drink more to compensate for the fact that they're passing more urine? Is she a diabetic? Unlikely, but that's always something else we have to look into because they will drink more and urinate more. There's some hormonal diseases that dogs can get, in particular one called Cushing's disease, where they produce too much cortisol, and that makes them do the same thing, drink more and urinate more. And usually there's going to be some other symptoms to make us think that that's what's going on, some hair loss and a pot belly and that kind of thing. So if she were to come in to see me, my first step would be to collect a sterile urine sample for your analysis. I'd probably be recommending getting some blood counts done, as well as having a full chemistry panel done so I can look at liver values, because sometimes they're up with Cushing's disease, kidney values, glucose house level and just get a good idea of what's going on. Sometimes those tests make us have to go through other tests, but, you know, this, you know, it is something that may or may not be able to be treated, like Cushing's disease can be treated. Kidney disease can be managed, but it may mean changing your household a little bit, more confinement, diapers if she's having trouble with, you know, overflow, getting a dog door so she can go out more frequently. You know, sometimes we do have to make some changes that way.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling. Karen in Sherwood, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Listen, thanks a lot for taking my call. I have a little dog named Poppet. She's 6 years old, a rescue. They think she's a border collie and a beagle. But she has always had a bit of separation anxiety. She's been a little nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have grandchildren.
Okay.
So my thought is, I've heard about this thunder vest.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, or a thunder shirt.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So I was wondering if a dog could wear that pretty much all day long if grandchildren were around, or if that would just defeat the purpose of the thunder vest. Or does the thunder vest even work? I mean, I don't know what to do.
The thing is, it can't hurt. Okay, so they are commercially available. They've been around for a number of years now. And the science behind it, actually, it was stuff that was noticed. There's a woman that does kind of like a touch or massage therapy called Linda Tellington Jones. And she came up with this T-touch method. And one of the things that she came up with was this way of wrapping an ACE bandage around a dog in an appropriate way to kind of, it creates it almost like swaddles them, like swaddling a baby. And with that, they ended up turning to making these commercially. And there's a couple of different companies that make them. There's one that's, you know, it fits a little bit. They kind of can sometimes fit a little bit differently. So you have to look at what's going to be best for your dog. We see a lot of dogs that are visiting the vet school now coming in with these shirts on because it makes the dog feel a little more comfortable when they're at the vet clinic. And I've heard lots of testimonials from people that they really think it makes a difference. You know, I've had one dog that had some cognitive decline, was up and wandering at night and just acting really anxious. And they put that on, the dog slept like a baby from that point on.
Yeah,
so,
great.
You know, so it's kind of individual dog things that we're seeing. I think they're not that expensive. It's much nicer than using medication. So if it works, great. If it doesn't, we go to the next step. So,
right.
Yeah.
So she can pretty much wear it all day, and it doesn't like desensitize her to.
No, not at all. Not at all. I would say put it on if it's working great. The other thing that I would add in is a dog appeasement pheromone collar. They're again available at pet stores and through your veterinarian. The brand that I'm most familiar with is called the DAP collar, or it's now been renamed the Adaptol collar, and it releases a pheromone that has a calming effect on dogs. Again, a non-medical way, kind of by dealing with aromatherapy with science behind it. So
mm-hmm.
Try using one of those as well.
Okay, I think I'll give it a shot. Like you say, it's better than medication and sedatives.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
If I stick her in a room, she thinks she's done something wrong.
Aww.
So,
yeah.
I think the vest is the way to go. So
okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Karen. Michael in Middleton, hi.
Oh, hey. Are you there?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Hey, I get really great care from the University of Wisconsin Vet School. I want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
14-year-old asthmatic cat, you know, about a year and a half, and then she took a dramatic downturn. Brought her in, we tried a bunch of things. They knocked down the asthma with prednisone.
Mm-hmm.
And we were great for a couple of days, and now she has lymphoma.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
After the second lavage. And I'm just wondering, my fiancé has heard good things about the chemo. I'm just wondering, you know, it's like, what's the trajectory from here, trying to manage both the asthma and the
Yeah, lung? And this would be something I'd have to defer to my oncology colleagues, that what I'm concerned about is if your cat is currently on steroids, prednisone, that can affect the ability of chemotherapy to work. Even though some steroids are used as part of the chemotherapy regime, if you treat a dog with prednisone, and then want to go back to using chemotherapy, it doesn't work as well. So it's kind of, it's, and so that may be one of the deciding factors. And I'm wondering if the episode that your cat had that you thought was an asthmatic episode was more the lymphoma, because there are lymph nodes in the chest cavity that can, and in the neck and so on, that can start compressing the airways and make your cat have some evidence of respiratory distress. And the steroids that they gave may have shrunk the lymph nodes down enough to make the cat breathe better, you thinking that the asthma was better, and then the steroids stopped and the lymph nodes bounced back up again, and now you've got your diagnosis.
We only, with the second thing with the prednisone has only been a short-term thing. She's usually been on the inhaler.
Okay.
So the second most recent episode, she took a really big downturn. I mean, I thought she was dead. And so they put her on prednisone for 3 days, and it just knocked everything down. She was great. And then mm-hmm. it's like, well, she has lymphoma.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that's, you know, I don't know. My theory is that she had the lymphoma before the steroids started, but who's to know?
Yeah,
I'm sorry, but yeah, at the oncology unit at the vet school, I would recommend that you give them a call. They've got various protocols for lymphoma. I'm not sure what they have for cats and whether your cat would even qualify. But that would be something to be looking into, and to see if, you know, if she would be a candidate with the fact that she did have a few days of steroids. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
There you go. Good luck.
You guys do very good work.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Tony in Wausau, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a couple questions. I have two herding dogs, a senior one and a pup. And my senior one has had Lymes in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I treat them. I know you put the medicine, you know, that stuff to repel the ticks.
Uh-huh.
And I treat him. He also has arthritis because he's an older dog. And he does well, but he picks it up. And now my young pup, because I didn't put him on anything to begin with because he was so young, he showed the signs of Lymes. Should mm-hmm. I be concerned and put him on anything, or should I wait for a sign?
Well, I think if you're concerned, taking your puppy in to your veterinarian and have them do a physical exam to see if does your puppy have some other form of arthritis. Like, you know, we do see puppies having inherited joint disease, and that may be why your dog is lame and having issues that way. They can also do some blood work to see if your dog is Lyme positive, and if that's the case, you know, potentially go through treatment. Most of the flea and tick medications, the safest one to use is the one your veterinarian recommends. That's the easiest way for me to get, you know, go, because there are so many great ones out there that are, you know, sold over the counter and at vet clinics, but your vet is going to be the one that is going to be able to know the subtle differences between, you know, this one and that one. And there are differences, even though they may say in the package, you know, when you're at, you know, Walmart or whatever, just like, you know, the one that your veterinarian would sell you, there are differences between some of those. So I would be checking with your vet as to what would be the safest one to use. Most of the flea and tick preparations are labeled for dogs 6, 7, 8 weeks and up. And so we can start using them very, very young, often when they're, you know, just leaving the litter. So it kind of depends on the product that you use. But if your pet is over 8 weeks, it should be on something, because we're in the middle of flea and tick season right now. So
at what age would you recommend neutering him? Different things, letting them develop the maturity so that he doesn't get bladder infections or urinary.
Yeah, that's
young.
Yeah, that is not a problem with male dogs, nor is it. It's kind of an old wives' tale with cats as well. So we like to neuter them before they start developing some of the annoying male behaviors. And so, when is that going to happen? Who knows? Because puberty varies all over the place. I typically had used two kind of milestones. One, making sure that they're finished with all their vaccinations and they've had the opportunity to mount a good immune response. The other one is whether all their permanent teeth have come in or not, especially in dogs that have an issue with retained deciduous teeth. That's a perfect time to remove their teeth. And so are usually around 6 months of age is the best time. But some people want them to develop a bigger bone structure. They don't want them to have the neutered male kind of more gangly appearance. And we'll say, well, let's let them mature and wait a little bit longer. The risk with that is you may develop some of these troublesome male behaviors that may not go away, like lifting his leg in the house and humping and chasing after the girls and fighting with boy dogs and all those things.
Whoa.
So, yeah, six months is what I would recommend.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Kelly sent us a Facebook question. as a 5-year-old female spayed cat, not outside much, but was out on a leash Sunday, ate some grass, threw up on Monday morning, again Monday afternoon, again this morning, saw grass in the first vomit, but not any afterwards. She had her teeth cleaned with anesthesia a week ago.
Well, some cats like to eat a salad now and then, and sometimes they overdo it. So the question is, did she eat the grass because she was feeling nauseous, or did she eat it just because she's a cat and she likes to have a salad? The fact that she's persistently vomiting, you know, she just went through an anesthetic procedure. Does she have any issues with you know, just going through anesthesia? Like, did it affect her kidneys or something? So give your veterinarian a call and see if, you know, how anesthesia went, if there was any other concerns that way. And, you know, again, if she, it may just be that the grass caused a lot of irritation, and switching to a softer diet like a canned food diet or a bland diet may help if it's just a minor problem with the grass irritation.
There we go. And Sandy, thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome.
Just to remind again, you're here, well, you're always here the second Tuesday of the month, so your next appearance is September 11th.
I will be here.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is a professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be back on September 11th. Just to look ahead to what's coming up tomorrow on the show at 11, Franklin Court is here to talk about his new book. It's Pioneers of Ecological Restoration, The People and Legacy of the UW Arboretum. Looking forward to that. Dave Michelson and Bob Dodd, Emeritus Professors of Geology, stop by at 11:45, and they'll talk about the geology of Wisconsin. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.
Today's primary election in Wisconsin will set the stage for this November. Join me, Sean Johnson, along with Frederica Freiberg for results and analysis.
We'll talk with political observers, candidates, and reporters from around the state tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Smart Toyota, presenting the entire Toyota Prius hybrid family, including the original Prius, Prius C, Prius V, and now the plug-in Prius. Test drives available at Smart Toyota.